Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So 2 weeks ago on this podcast, I spoke with my former Intercept colleague, Kate Aronoff, who now covers climate and energy for the New Republic. And we talked about her experience covering a major energy conference in Houston called CERA Week.
To give people a bit of background, I don't go to a ton of corporate conferences, but I assume this genre of thing happens somewhat often. But the other night there was, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of CERA Week, a musical put on by Broadway performers who, you know, themselves very talented, no gripe with them, certainly. But the musical sort of told the story of the U.S. oil and gas industry through a series of edited Broadway show tunes, which is exactly as bad as you think it is, and much worse, I would argue. I was physically taken aback.
The war in Ukraine has renewed conversations in Washington about actually passing a major clean energy package, and Joe Manchin at the conference laid out in some pretty precise detail what exactly he was willing to support and at what cost. Among people following this issue closely, there's now real confidence that a major package might actually get done, even after it was left for dead in December amid a heap of finger-pointing and recriminations. But listening to Manchin outline what he was for and what he was against, I realized I wasn't really familiar enough with the current state of the clean energy industry to understand if what he was saying was blowing smoke or serious. He laid out a lot of his thinking at a press conference at CERA Week, which Kate wrote about for TNR. She also shared audio with us from the press conference. Now, one of the people I've trusted for years on this question of what technology is real is an old friend of mine named Ducky Hune, who I met back when we were both just out of college. His career took a sharp turn about 15 years ago when he got deep into the world of fossil fuel energy conservation and carbon tech. We spend a lot of time in this podcast hovering at 30,000 feet or diving hundreds of years back into history or talking in theoretical big picture terms, but today I wanted to try to get a handle on exactly what we mean when we say clean energy and what's actually doable in the short, medium, and long term. Ducky Hune, welcome to Deconstructed.
Thank you for having me.
And so, Ducky, you're founder, right, of Green Cooling Tower Solutions.
One of the founders, yes.
So to let the listeners in on how we put this episode together, you and I met, what, 22, 23 years ago? Very long time ago in New York City. You were dating a very good friend of my girlfriend. Both of those girlfriends have now become our wives. And you and I have, you know, stayed in touch over the years, and I've been really excited to watch, you know, the journey that you've taken in different directions. But you've been doing this for at least a decade, and prior to this had gotten into kind of clean energy before a lot of people really had any idea what clean energy and not just clean energy, but all of the concomitant reduction of emissions and pollutions around it. So give us a little bit of a rundown of what you've been up to the last 20 years, and also, you know, what is Green Cooling Tower Solutions do so that as people listen to your assessment of where we're headed, they'll know, you know, where you might have your own biases and where you've got your own expertise.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, it's been quite a long time, and our career paths have definitely gone in different directions there. But when I left New York right around that time, probably in 05 or 06, I felt like I wanted to get my feet on the ground a little bit more to really explore the food, energy, water matrix that really was, you know, really could use a lot of improvement. So I am originally from Louisiana, so I moved back down to raise family, obviously, and to explore that with where I could find a lot of industries located nearby. So that was what drove me here. And around 2012, we got a technology. It's an energy efficiency patent, essentially, that was we introduced to industrial refiners. And it was mainly just a play to get a lot more efficiency out of energy efficiency out of industrial processes. We've taken that into a lot of different avenues. We've used that for wastewater treatment. We've used it for evaporation technologies and desalination technologies. And our most recent foray into with using offtake of the technology is carbon capture. So it's something that we've been working on for quite some time. So we have been working on kind of the renewable slash waste stream industrial processes. So we've familiarized ourselves quite a bit with how things work and how we can make them better, essentially.
And, you know, I enjoy talking about this kind of stuff because being in Washington, it's easy to become extremely pessimistic about the future here and to just not see, you know, much hope at all for where this is headed. But in the background, as Washington has been completely, you know, failing to keep up its end of the bargain, you know, there have been some, you know, serious advances that if they can be kickstarted, you know, if they can get some federal push, it feels like there's still a shot. And so you and I were talking recently about Joe Manchin's appearance at the CERAWeek conference, which is this gigantic Houston energy conference, where he talked in specific detail about what he would be willing to support when it comes to basically a climate package. Now, he also wants other elements of it. He wants tax increases on the rich and major corporations. He wants half of it to go toward deficit reduction. He wants to do the drug price negotiation piece, and then he's fine using the other half of that toward energy. But he wants all energy subsidized, not just clean energy. But there hasn't been much attention focused on how detailed he's been in going into what he's willing to get behind. And so, first of all, this CERAWeek conference. So it's not a unique conference. There's a ton of these giant oil industry conferences that happen around the world. You know, I know there's been a pandemic on for the last couple of years, but when you used to go to these conferences, you know, what were they like and what was it like coming to them with energy efficiency solutions?
Well, when I started going to these, probably early 2010s, wasn't a lot of talk about it. I mean, it was a lot of business as usual. So introducing these type of technologies was difficult, to say the least. A lot of these industries, and for good reason, just keep doing what they're doing. And that's always been our biggest obstacle, and I'm sure a lot of other companies feel the same, is getting these companies to change what they're doing because what they're doing works to a certain extent. And they've built a lot of big walls for them to keep doing what they're doing, essentially, with legislation, pricing, a lot of regulation. So it's been very difficult.
And when you say it works, you mean it's profitable for them?
Exactly. I mean, I wouldn't say it's completely efficient the way they're doing things, and there's obviously a lot of room for improvement, but they make money and their system works.
Yeah, and Manchin, and we'll get to this later on in the episode, but he even specifically starts talking about these companies, and he's like, if there are proven, you know, efficiencies out there that you're not taking advantage of just because you're too lazy to, you shouldn't exist. It's like a kind of a radical like line from Manchin, and I want to get to that one later, but let's start with Manchin's first response to New York Times reporter at the conference.
Senator Manchin, hi, Lisa Friedman from the New York Times. Two questions. Could you tell us where things are on negotiations over reconfiguring the Build Back Better?
There is no Build Back Better.
Would you vote on the climate provision?
Let me go in. I don't mean that to be sarcastic. That bill is a major mammoth piece of legislation, okay? And the reason I had concerns from day one is that we shouldn't be doing that much policy. Reconciliation was never designed for us to do policy. It was designed for us to get our financial house in order. It truly was. But here we are. changing the whole social restructuring of our society. And that was the biggest thing that I had. Okay, there's so many good things in there that we all have aspirations to do. A lot of good things. But with that, it should go through a process where there's a hearing. It's transparent. It's open to the public. And then we have a markup. We have a markup, and the markup basically is where people put their ideas to make it better or something they think will be detrimental to their area. That's the process we have. We bypassed all that. So I said, no. Now, what we're talking about now is that one thing that all Democrats agreed on was the 2017 tax cuts, the way they were implemented, were weighted unfairly. And it did not basically spin off the amount of revenue we needed to pay down our debt. So we're $30 trillion 200 billion as of this morning is our debt right now. And it grows every day, every day. You've got to change that trajectory. So I says, if we all agree and we have agreement on one thing, then use it to get your financial house in order. Basically, get the tax code that's competitive, that's fair, allows us to compete and grow and be prosperous, but pay the bills. And then use revenue from that to pay down debt to get your finances in order. We can still do that. We can still do the one with the drug thing. I said, that's the most popular thing we have. Getting our drugs. We know we can do that. And then we can do maybe an all-in, all-inclusive climate package to some extent. And that basically, they know where I stand. If it doesn't have an all-in policy to where you're treating the horsepower that you need from your fossil, which is coal, oil, and natural gas. Okay, and the investments that we're going to need in the new nuclear reactors, if you will, and also in geothermal, and all the things that we're talking about with our wind and solar and all that, you can't just abandon one, and that's what they were doing. I said, I'm not for that. So we'll see if they want to go down that path or not.
Can I just ask, how do you reconcile investing more in oil and gas with the IEA that said, if we want to hit 1.5, we need to stop exploration, investment in fossil fuels?
Well, we need to do it cleaner than we've ever done it before, and we do it. We do produce oil, and we do extract oil, and we do it better than most any place in the world.
So that's Joe Manchin, his own words, laying out kind of the broad contours of his package, and then he says that he wants all the different horses funded. So from your perspective, if Democrats do take this approach, and this seems to be it's either take it or leave it, like it's either this or there's nothing. If there is this across the board, all energy is subsidized, is it still a big win for the clean energy side? Because right now, the field is tilted heavily against them.
I think it's a win. I mean, anything is a win that supports, an early technology. So fortunately, higher energy cost, high fossil fuel energy cost, it actually helps early technology companies in efficiency and alternative energy, renewable energy. It really does help us quite a bit because the alternative is paying high fossil fuel prices. So we do get a lot more attention when prices are high. So it does help us quite a bit. I mean, I'm personally not against fossil fuels. I mean, we do help fossil fuels become more efficient. And I think that's a big key to what Mr. Manchin's talking about. I mean, I don't know him that well, but I mean, I did listen into his responses here, and I have to agree to a lot of them. I mean, we do have to provide fossil fuels an off-ramp, essentially, to become greener as the renewables and next-generation technologies take place. And I think that off-ramp is going to be quite long.
Right, and it's a recognition that that is the reality of it. And so he goes into a lot more detail coming up, so let's play the next clip here.
With that being said, seeing what's happening in Europe right now, in Ukraine, I think that's a whole difference. It's called global. It's a global market. It's not just the United States market. So if we go down the path and we exclude all the fossils quicker than the rest of the world is dependent upon, okay? And I've said this, you take us out of the fossil business, there will not be another country that will step up and spend the money for technology and other research and development is going to be needed to use it cleaner because they're going to still use it. They're going to still use it. And they want to put a carbon fee and all these things, and they want to put basically a border adjustment, a border fee. Not until you have the technology can you justify doing that. The bottom line is if we have technology that shows you can use certain products, whether it be oil, gas, oil, and coal, and you're not using the latest, greatest technology to reduce the emissions from it, then you're going to pay a price to get into our market. That's how you enforce it, and that's how basically you get the rest of the world to move in and transition. But just thinking to yourself, don't use it. Go tell Modi that.
A couple premises I want to interrogate there. One is, if we move off of fossil fuels, he's saying that there's nobody else in the world that's going to jump in and do, he's going to do the research and do the investment to move, you know, quickly. And, you know, they're going to continue to use fossil fuels until the planet burns or whatever. And then secondly, he talks about forcing the industry to use the latest, greatest, as he calls it, technology. So what do you think of that first premise, and what does it take to do the second thing?
I have to agree with them that if the U.S. gets off of oil or fossil altogether, and the research doesn't support emissions reduction, I have to agree that there are very few bodies that could support our industries like the U.S. government could. I mean, I use a lot of technology, and I use a lot of scientists from government research labs, and these guys have been doing this for a long time. Some of the smartest guys in the world, obviously, and you can't get that for free. I mean, that it costs a lot of money, and it takes a long time to get technologies like that to market. And I mean, I know some of these technologies a bit.
And what kind of technologies?
I mean, we're talking about next generation nuclear, you know, fission reactors. We're talking about electrolysis, new efficient electrolysis methods.
And what's that? What's an electrolysis?
Electrolysis is essentially electrolyzing, any material. But what we're talking about in this conversation is electrolysis of either water to create hydrogen, and I know hydrogen is a big topic that Manchin's talking about, or electrolyzing carbon dioxide, CO2, essentially to create hydrogen or taking the next step and to produce carbon neutral fuels out of CO2, essentially. So that's been a big area of research and development right now that's coming to market right now.
Taking CO2 out of the air and producing energy with it?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's two methods you could look at. There's point source, which is essentially capturing at the point of emission, which is like at a power plant or refinery, essentially. Or there's a direct air capture. It's just picking, any piece of real estate and putting up a carbon capture plant and just capturing it directly from the air.
And you said it's starting to come to market?
It is. I believe there's been some smaller installations in Europe and Canada that have been piloted. And I know there's another one proposed to be built in West Texas probably next year, which would dwarf, even the largest ones built to date by many times over. It's new technology. It's proven, but there still will be a lot of room for improvement. I think the price per ton of carbon with these technologies is quite high. I think everyone's kind of in the race to get the price per ton of carbon, well below what these technologies are capable of.
Gotcha. All right, let's roll some more Manchin.
Senator, hi, Miranda Wilson of Community News. The clean energy tax provisions in the Build Back Better Act are a priority for the administration, also for electric utilities right now. Is that something that you would support in a standalone climate package?
Which one do you want to ask about?
I guess all of them.
Well, first of all, the 4,500, that's gone. Okay, that was just, to me, it was non-starter. Basically, I come from Union State, and I support Union and everything I can, but you just can't start picking and choosing. You use this product. I said, do you want a cleaner environment? Do you want an EV vehicle or not? Now you're going to start giving favors on who produces it? It didn't make any sense to me. Now, if we're going to get an EV business, we know there has to be some incentives. So there will be incentives in that to a certain extent if that's where we go. I'm just not putting all my eggs in one basket. So whatever I do for EVs, I do exactly for hydrogen, because I truly believe I'm not going to get caught. If I have one vote to get our country caught in a situation we're totally dependent on one direction and one mode of transportation, and right now that I know 80-90% is controlled by China, and the way that they're enslaving people around the world to get the resources they do for the refineries, I'm not going down there. And here's the other thing I would do. I'm going to put a sunset. You tell me you're going to do all these things, we're going to start producing in America, we're going to start refining in America. and yet you're still depending on China and all the rest of the world to do the heavy lifting and dirty work, but you want the results from that. If we don't start producing ourselves, then those credits should go away. They should be sunsetted because you're not serious. So if you're serious and you're an environmental community and you're serious, let's get with it. Let's start working together. Don't take me to court every time you don't like what I'm doing.
All right, I don't know exactly what he means about being taken to court every second that you don't like resume, but on the electric vehicles, he basically the 4,500 there, correct me if I'm wrong, he's saying that in the original bill, the tax credits, the incentives for electric vehicles were only going to union car companies. Now, under his version, any electric vehicle company would be able to get them, and he makes a clean point, which is if you believe that this is a civilization-level catastrophic event, you can't hold it up over union wages. Okay, fine. And again, Manchin is Manchin, so he's going to get his way on a lot of this stuff. He talked a lot at this event about hydrogen. Now, I don't know anything about hydrogen. How serious is hydrogen as a potential clean energy fuel? Because my basic understanding is currently it takes a lot of energy to make it. But I'm curious for your read on what the prospects are for hydrogen and why you think he might be so excited about it.
Well, obviously it's getting a lot of press these days, hydrogen. It's already used every day in industrial processes, you know, refining, fertilizer, food processing. I guess the excitement around hydrogen today is the ability for it to displace liquid fuels for transportation like gasoline, diesel. I think it's very promising. I mean, obviously that's something we're working on today, but I think it's more geared towards hard to electrify vehicles like ships, planes, you know, long distance trucks. It's already in use. I mean, you can find hydrogen fuel stations. They're limited today, but I'm sure they'll expand quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's there today. It's there today. It works, but you're right. It is energy intensive. It really is.
And I guess am I right? It makes use of a lot of current fossil fuel infrastructure. He talks later about pipelines. You know, if they stopped moving natural gas or they stop moving oil, the pipelines could move hydrogen. Is that one of the reasons that the industry is excited about hydrogen, that so much of the infrastructure is already there for it?
That's exactly why. I mean, you don't have to buy a new car. You don't have to buy a new ship or a plane if you convert the hydrogen into a liquid fuel. But hydrogen to fuel these purposely built vessels with engines capable of burning hydrogen, there is some infrastructure there already available. So, you know, hydrogen and CO2 pipelines are definitely already underway. I mean, I know there's been a lot of infrastructure for CO2 especially, but I know hydrogen's right behind it. I don't see why government shouldn't greenlight those pipelines right away. I mean, it's maybe it's part of this Defense Production Act. Hopefully. Hopefully they see the importance of CO2 and hydrogen pipelines to get the industry moving in the right direction. But going to your first point, hydrogen is it's deceptive. I mean, there are different types of hydrogen, different ways to produce hydrogen, essentially. And today, I mean, I'd say over 90% of it is fossil fuel based. So it isn't quite clean. So, I mean, I don't know if you... if you've seen the color matrix of hydrogen, but it's a little confusing because hydrogen is, you know, odorless and colorless, but people have put a lot of different colors to the matrix of hydrogen. So they call coal and lignite gasification, you know, hydrogen produced by coal and lignite, gray and black. Brown, which is the most common type of hydrogen, is used by steam methane reforming of natural gas. So it's not quite clean at all. The big rage now is blue hydrogen. And it's essentially the same as brown, but steam methane reforming of natural gas. But they put a twist on it, which is they capture the carbon produced by that process. So it is it's better, but it's definitely not, it's not carbon neutral at all. It's much better than brown. And then there's, you know, green, which everyone hopes to achieve, which is using electrolysis, like I mentioned before, to, on water and electrolysis, which is the huge demand on on power. So if you use electrolysis from renewable energy, it turns the hydrogen green, essentially.
Gotcha.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, let's jump to the next Manchin cut where he talks about production tax credits and more on hydrogen and then some on transmission.
My question is, what are you willing to do on wind and solar?
Transmission.
Oh, yeah. What are you willing to do specifically? Like, if there was a bill that came, what would you want to do?
Well, basically, we have a 10-year production tax credit on all of these credits that we've been giving, and also production tax credits. They cut down, basically, hydrogen to 6 years from 10. I'm going to put it back to 10. If we have a bill, I'll treat them all the same. Everyone gets treated the same. They want a transmission for us, basically, for the Treasury to pay and incur indebtedness on the amount of money that we build transmission lines. I said, I'll defer, but I'm not going to give you the money because I know how profitable transmission is. You will pay back eventually, okay? But the bottom line is we will stoke the fires, if you will, to build them quicker, to build the transmission, because most of the large wind and large solar is going to be in areas that we don't have a large population or network of transmission. So I'm all for those. I'm all for that. I'm also for the pipelines, basically, that could be retrofitted and re-sleeved for hydrogen lines. We should be looking at that, too. But, you know, because building a pipeline, God, that's an unmerciful task.
You know, first of all, I love the way that he uses the I when you're talking about this legislation that's supposed to be written by the House and the Senate. He's like, I'll defer because it's profitable. But he's not wrong. It's his call. So what does he mean here, though? I don't care too much about this 6 year to 10 year thing. That feels like in the weeds. But if there's something interesting there, feel free to let me know. But I'm curious about when he's talking about transmission. He talks about West Virginia having, you know, massive wind farms, but also West Virginia being nowhere near people, and so you need to get that energy, you know, where it needs to go. So how much of a role does the federal government need to play in ramping up that capacity?
Well, I really do think they have to be the lead. I mean, when he's talking about the time frames, I mean, a lot of companies are basing their investment decisions on that runway, essentially. If the runway is too short, then obviously that investment decision is uncertain. Right. So.
Oh, you mean the 6 to 10?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So I mean.
So that is actually important. So it's important to get the money in off the sidelines, because if it looks like they have 10 years, then it's worth investing. Whereas 6, it might not be.
Exactly.
Okay.
So,
interesting.
I mean, that's very important for on investment decisions. I mean, and we're talking about large quantity and maybe low margin, essentially, when a lot of players get into the game. So if it's not subsidized, you know, by the government, then obviously the market forces kind of dictate. So a lot of investment decisions are based on subsidies, you know, in those time frames. I mean, I know we're talking about these carbon credits, essentially with a 12-year horizon, and we'd like to see more certainty in it, or extensions even. When you're talking about these projects, I mean, these projects have to be planned long in advance, and they have to have some kind of certainty for payback, or else, not a lot of people have these kind of pockets to spend hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars on a plant. You are going to the banks, and they want to see some certainty in the projections.
That makes sense. They don't want to be a year or two into getting off the ground and then the subsidy vanishes because Congress decided to have a government shutdown over like a wall or something.
Absolutely. And I think that's a real big obstacle for a lot of these projects to get kicked off.
Right. You just can't trust that it's going to be there. So what about on the transmission side? How far are we away from where we need to be?
We're a lot better than we were when we started wind in these remote areas. Solar was a little bit better, but I don't know if you remember wind. We had a lot of wind farms out in Midwest that were connected to essentially nothing. They were essentially on an island, and it took a long time to get transmission connected to population centers. So essentially, what happened was the credits got way ahead of infrastructure, so transmission wasn't connected. A lot of banks capitalized on the tax credits, but the electricity just didn't get anywhere. But I mean, when we talk about transmission, benefiting, the future of energy, I think we have to start talking about smart grids, how electric cars can maybe even work both ways, to supply power when necessary, instead of just being parked in the driveway. So I think there's a lot of room for improvement in that space. It's not my specialty, but I think it's really interesting to know that electric vehicles can actually supply power to the grid, if the regulation is there and the will of the power company is there to allow that to happen, because obviously that cuts into their, into their business plan, essentially.
Right. Okay, the next cut is him talking about pipelines.
I'm also for the pipelines, basically, that could be retrofitted and re-sleeved for hydrogen lines. We should be looking at that, too. But, because building a pipeline, God, that's an unmerciful task.
My question was really on solar and wind.
Solar and wind, I support, trust me, in West Virginia, we have one of the largest wind farms, east of Mississippi, and I'm all for wind, I'm all for solar. But it can only do so much right now. And in storage, I'm all for storage. We're looking at that. We're putting a lot of money in research and development for technology for storage. I'm supportive of all of the above. I just don't want to be counting on something until I see it's there. I guess that's it.
Yeah, so where are we when it comes to storage and wind and solar capacity?
Well, storage is tricky because there's not a lot of big options in the utility space, utility scale storage. I mean, there's obviously pump storage, but there's limited places you can use that. Essentially, using unused energy, maybe renewable, hopefully, or next generation nuclear, something that's that might not be used during certain hours of the day, and pumping it way upstream to elevation, and just essentially building a hydro dam essentially to use the energy when necessary. So that's the only very large utility scale storage option that's been used to date. I mean, I know batteries technologies are come a long way, but as you see with the metals crunch that we're having because of this Russia-Ukraine situation, there's some uncertainty there too. And obviously, metals are expensive, and even the largest lithium storage facility could only power the nearby city for a matter of minutes. So we're not quite there with battery storage.
And so let's jump to the last Manchin clip where he talks about methane flaring.
Are you going to require a crackdown on flaring and methane emissions and any accountability?
Anytime there's technology, if technology is proven, okay, and you don't use technology, then shame on you. Go out, you should be out of business. If you're basically not using the technology that has been proven, into the fill that will reduce the emissions, and you won't use it because of the bottom line, the profit, you shouldn't be in business. I have no problem there. But on the other hand, there's a transition that goes on. I'll give you a perfect example. Back in Clean Air Act, I come from coal country, where we come from, and the bottom line was we were switching. They did coal switching at first until the scrubbers came online, low NOx boilers and baghouses for mercury. Then we were able to. You had to met. If you didn't switch in a period of time, you were out. And we shut down a lot of the older plants. And basically with flaring right now, let's build the pipelines. Let them build the pipelines that takes the methane off in the gathering points. That's what they tell me. That if I'm wrong here, you all might know more than I know about that, but that's what I hear from the field. They can't get the pipeline to take, and so they're getting condemned for the flaring and the emissions that come. But now I hear from the large drillers from our horizontal, in the east anyway, in West Virginia, in the big Marcellus and Utica Shale, they're capturing methane. They have not a bit of problem. I just think that, we ought to be able to, as government, be very clear in our regulatory agencies of what we expect you to do and why we expect it. If it makes sense because there's technology and here's how you do it better, I should be working with you, not against you. Now, once I go out the first time and say, you made a mistake here, you know you're wrong, here's how you have to change it, every 90 days to start changing this. I come back for the second visit and you haven't, I'm going to fine you. The third visit, I'm going to shut you down. About as simple as that. That's how I govern my government.
That's the radical mansion I love to hear. He's going to shut you down if you're not using the technology that exists just for your bottom line. But what does he mean when he says that these drillers are doing methane flaring because they don't have the pipeline capacity? And is this something that Build Back Better was supposed to address? I mean, clearly, if it's written by Manchin, it will. But what's he talking about, basically?
Yeah, so this is actually something that we worked with many years ago with the trapped gas in upstream oil and gas production. You have to think of these places being very remote, and if there isn't a large volume of gas to be sent via pipeline, it's not very efficient to transport it either by truck or other means by storage. Essentially, so it's essentially trapped gas, so it's not cost effective for them to transport it unless they do have a pipeline, and they haven't built it, these pipelines to these very remote very remote wells, just because of the cost. So it has become a big problem just because the wells have gotten bigger, they've been more remote, and we drilled more. It's a big big problem. I mean, if you've ever flown into Midland, Texas, I mean, you would think the city would be millions. The lights would be reflective of a city that might be in the millions, but it's essentially just flares in the air, right? So it looks like a big city. That's all it is. Yeah. So it's trapped gas. It's not cost effective to move it, but maybe the price of natural gas stays at a level where it's feasible for them to build the pipelines that they haven't built already. It's obviously the reason that it hasn't been built, obviously, is because historically natural gas has been relatively cheap. I mean, just this last month was a major spike, but for them we weren't talking about natural gas being very expensive since the Enron days, from early 2000s.
Right.
So
why are they burning it? Why don't they just leave it in the ground? Like what am I missing there?
Well, it comes up with the oil, right? So the oil is they have the oil pipelines. So the methane comes up with the oil as well with the, other materials. I mean, there's produced water, methane, and oil. So they separate it and essentially pipeline the oil to the refineries or to the ships, but the methane, they still haven't figured out the methane problem. So, I mean, we have worked with them and they do have a few smaller solutions to use the methane in production in some ancillary processes that they might use on site. But they just haven't found the cost benefit analysis to work out to build the pipelines to these remote facilities for just gas.
And methane, correct me if I'm wrong, is what, 100 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon, but it moves out of the atmosphere faster. What is, how bad is this? Like when you fly into Midland and you see those lights burning, are you like, oh God, we are so screwed?
Well, it's discouraging, to say the least. I mean, it's very discouraging because there are ways to use the trap gas for other purposes. I mean, not only does West Texas have a gas, a methane problem, but they have a water problem as well. So we're trying to find ways, and I'm sure we're not the only ones trying to do it, to solve a lot of problems with the same solution. So it's discouraging because I know there are things that can be done to, you know, kind of to take care of a lot of problems with the same solution. So, I mean, the methane, so there's, not a lot of talk about it, but many years ago, maybe not that many, maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, Oklahoma and West Texas had a big problem with earthquakes. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. I do remember but, that.
It was, you know, daily earthquakes. I mean, small earthquakes, but a lot more frequent than ever before. And what the problem was not the fracking, not the drilling exercises, but it was wastewater disposal. They were actually injecting wastewater that came up with the oil and gas in these production wells, and injecting it into dry wells or spent wells, whichever wells they could, you know, feasibly truck it to the water and just pump it down hole. So they were actually pumping at such a velocity and pressure, volume and pressure, that it lubricated the tectonic plates.
Jeez.
So that's what created all the seismic activity. And I mean, a lot of companies in the industry don't talk about it, but it, I mean, there was a direct correlation. So as soon as they limited the pressure and the volume of these disposal wells, the seismic activity, you know, reduced quite substantially. So not only do they have that problem with disposal water, but they have a groundwater problem too, because they're using so much water in the production to get the oil and gas out. So it seems like it would make sense for them to use all the energy, which is the methane, to clean the water. And I know there are a lot of companies that are working on that problem right now, not just us.
Gotcha. We're taping this on Thursday. We just reported, my colleagues, Noska Renner and Austin Alma, just reported that the Biden administration is drafting an order that would invoke the Defense Production Act. It's not clear if they will implement it, but they're drafting it, and we obtained a copy of it, that would basically kind of use this 1950s-era law that would say that we're in a crisis and we're going to use the Defense Production Act to secure mining access to the minerals and the elements needed for clean energy. How useful is that, given that so many of the elements are actually outside of the United States? And where are we going to get the different ingredients that we need for this clean energy revolution?
Well, I mean, I know, given the circumstances, I mean, with Russia, Ukraine, Russia does, you know, is a large producer of metals, but not quite the metals that everyone would think of. That you know, they're definitely not one of the largest lithium producers. They are a large producer of, say nickel, which is, you know, very important for batteries and stainless steel. But you know, a lot of other ones are that they produce, you know, maybe not as important for electric vehicles in particular. But I would guess that lithium production, which is mainly Australia, South America, could come to the United States. I mean, lithium is pretty abundant in nature. You can even extract it from seawater. There are a lot of companies that are looking at extracting it from wastewaters and waste streams, essentially. So it is pretty abundant. It's just in different streams, it's in lower quantities, lower percentages. So there's, you know, it really depends on how much of an overburden you have to get through to get to the lithium, and how energy intensive it is to get there. But I've seen a lot of promising technologies for lithium production in the United States.
And so, as somebody who's in, you know, right in the heart of this industry, where are you on the hope scale that we're going to be able to come out of this with a sustainable future for our children, our grandchildren, and their children?
Well, it's really hard to look that far into the future, but I mean, I think it's very feasible. I mean, I see technologies that are working today at pilot scales and small scales that might be ready for, you know, large scale production, maybe in 3 to 5 years, that can really change the landscape of what we're doing now. But that doesn't mean that they'll be adopted by any means, which is, you know, the whole problem with introducing new technologies. I mean, just because it works.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This doesn't mean that you'll be financially successful. And that's probably been true with a lot of people, you know, that came before me. But I'm optimistic that, you know, this next generation nuclear can make a dramatic change for power generation, obviously. So I see that we can do a lot of things that can use renewables, but we still need something like a nuclear to be reliable enough for these companies to build these plants in certain locations, you know, for a reliable power source. So maybe we're not talking about refining and fossil fuel type companies anymore that depend on this energy. Maybe we're talking about carbon capture plants that use a lot of electrolysis, you know, a few years from now. Maybe these next generation nuclear plants are built just to power carbon capture plants and to get, you know, that'll really get us to carbon negative as quickly as possible. So I'm optimistic that the technology is there. We just have to make sure that there's enough support to get us to viability and financial success.
Well, I guess that's up to Joe Manchin. Ducky, thanks so much for taking some time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Ducky Hume, CEO and director at Green Cooling Tower Solutions, and that's our show. Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. This episode was produced by Jose Olivares. Our producer is Zach Young. Laura Flynn is our supervising producer. The show was mixed by William Stanton. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Betsy Reed is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm Ryan Grimm, DC Bureau Chief of The Intercept. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/give. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. If you enjoy this podcast, be sure to also check out Intercepted as well as Murderville, which is now in its second season. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. And please go leave us a rating or a review, or both. It helps people find the show. If you want to give us additional feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much. See you soon.